I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Edge Dundicott was born in Haiti and immigrated with her brother to the U.S. when she was 12 years old. Her parents had moved to Brooklyn when she was a little girl. She had stayed in Haiti and lived with her Aunt Denise and her father's brother, her Uncle Joseph, who was a pastor in Port-au-Prince. Her new memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, is about growing up in Haiti, the relationship between her father and uncle, and her life in America. In 2004, her father was diagnosed with terminal pulmonary fibrosis. She discovered that she was pregnant, and her uncle fled Haiti after his church had been destroyed and his life was threatened. He was detained in Florida, where he was asking for temporary asylum. He was denied entrance to the country, denied access to his medicine, and died 5 days later. A reviewer in the Christian Science Monitor said Dundicott has written a beautiful memoir to both her fathers. If there's such a thing as a warm-hearted tragedy, Brother, I'm Dying is a stunning example. Edwige Dundicott, it's a great pleasure to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. It's wonderful to be back. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You've said that this is really more than a book. It's really a promise that you made, a promise to these two men in your life.
A promise to my father, who, even as he lay dying, was questioning his life. And also to my uncle, who had always wanted to write a book. He was sort of the documentarian of our family, the archivist. And because he had had throat surgery early on and could not speak, was always keeping notes. So I really do feel like I've written this book because they can't.
I've also ran across a quote that you said, this is the most important story in your life.
It is the most important story of my life. I feel as though everything I've ever written so far has been training for it. It's probably the most necessary, personally necessary story I've told. But also it's a story that echoes so many larger issues, in the sense that there are many families, you know, immigrant families, especially in this time that we live in now, when people think of, you know, they think of us in a block, you know, mm-hmm. People will say 12 million illegals, and we forget that there are families behind these numbers, that there are mothers and fathers and people like my father who sacrificed their whole lives to working in this country, and other people who've stayed back home who tried to make these places better so that more people don't have to leave in the first place.
So you said such a personal story to you. You've written, I think, 4 novels, or you certainly all your other books have been fiction. Was this a different experience just as a writer to be writing about your own life, your uncle's, your life in Haiti, life in America?
Yeah, it was an extraordinarily different experience, because I'd never really thought that I would write a memoir, because I feel like this was the well that I was, you know, drawing from, and that I was using some of my material, you know, parceling it out through the fiction.
Right.
So I hadn't really thought of doing this kind of writing, because I almost felt like it would have been bad luck to just kind of show the seams of what I've been doing. But when this, when my uncle died in immigration custody and my father died, it just propelled me. I felt like I needed to process it through, because this is what I do, and this is how I process things. And for me, one of the great puzzles of this is that my father and my uncle, who lived, my uncle in Haiti and my father here for 30 years, they lived apart and now are buried together in Queens, New York. So the book, in a way, is sort of about unraveling this puzzle and trying to come up with to answer this question of why this happened.
And even more poignant, these two men die, but you're pregnant and you have a baby girl.
Mm-hmm.
The it's almost cliche life-death question.
Yeah, I mean, it's cliched, I guess, for a reason, because one of the things that my uncle, as a minister in Haiti, you know, he was a great giver of homilies at funerals. And one of the things that he always used to say is that, you know, we began to die almost the moment we were born. And he used to say that, you know, if we understood death or life in its fullness, we would cry at births as well. So that whole, I mean, those things to us were, you know, and at least through his faith and the way and his preaching were always connected. So it was really strange that they all came together, for example, that I found out almost the very day that my father got his diagnosis, I wasn't feeling well, and that's the same day I also found out that I was pregnant. So it was really a cycle, and throughout my father's entire illness, we were so concerned, and he was consumed with the idea of seeing my daughter, which he eventually got to do. So that whole idea of that cycle really worked out for us.
You mentioned bad luck, and I wonder, are you a superstitious writer? I often think that people that work by themselves, it's easy to become superstitious because you're sort of in your own head.
Yeah, I mean, I think all writers know this, and some of us don't want to talk about it too much because you feel like you'll unravel the mystery. But there is something very mystical or mysterious, if we'll, about any act of creation, you know, about having something emerge from your mind or from your, you know, whether you're a visual artist or a writer or a musician, you know, just something emerging, it seems, out of the air, and this idea that you're a vessel for something. And I felt this very much with this book, you know, especially after my uncle and father died. I did feel like every time I sat down to write, I was with them again. You know, I could make myself go back. So this was an act of recreation of them, but also a way of extending our relationship together.
You say you write to understand, and I'm assuming that's what writers do, right? Whether to understand the world, to understand your own life, your own inner life.
Yeah, I mean, I feel, for me, just if I want to understand something, the best way to do it is to write about it, to get a closer view at it. And in this kind of writing, you really get closer to the bone. You know, you're peeling layers and asking questions, sometimes uncomfortable questions, and you really have to step back and examine loved ones in a different way than you do as a person. You know, when you want to write about them. So it's a bit of a discovery too, as one is going along.
Your parents left for America when you were a little girl. Your brother was a little boy, just a couple years younger than you, Bob. Excuse me. And it's painful to read about being left behind. I mean, these are your parents, and they're coming to America, obviously looking for a better life. But in order to do that, they have to leave their children behind.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what's important to remember is that it's not an atypical pattern of migration for a lot of us who are from the Caribbean, you know, is that the parents often, my father, you know, went first and then my mother followed. Because really when my father moved to the States in 1971, he didn't know anyone here. And so he was just coming, it was just a brave new world, and he wanted to set the path for us, and then got caught up, like a lot of families are these days too, in a kind of immigration red tape, and that he wasn't able to send for us for at least 10 years from the time that he got here. So it wasn't unusual, and it was seen as a way that to sort of make the transition of the children easier, because where would they leave us with when they were here?
Sure.
And we always had family back home to keep us. So I didn't feel abandoned, because we were constantly in touch with my parents through letters, through cassettes, and in later through the telephone. So, and we knew so many children who were in the same situation, so it didn't feel like we were left behind.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from the book, and you were living with your aunt and uncle, and your father would send letters every couple of months or so, and it was your job, I guess, to read these letters.
Yeah, my father was, he always said that he was not much of a writer, but the letters were sort of his obligatory correspondence with us, and they served a very, you know, logistical purpose in that it was just telling us what to do with the money. But this is how it went. Listening to my father, I remembered a time when I used to dream of smuggling him words. I was 8 years old, and Bob and I were living in Haiti with his oldest brother, my uncle Joseph, and his wife. And since they didn't have a telephone at home, few Haitian families did then, and access to the call centers was costly, we had no choice but to write letters. Every other month, my father would mail a half-page, three-paragraph missive addressed to my uncle, scribbled in his minuscule scrawl, sometimes on plain white paper, other times on lined hole-punched notebook pages, still showing bits of fringe from the spiral binding. My father's letters were composed in stilted French, with the first paragraph offering news of his and my mother's health, the second detailing how to spend the money they had wired for food, lodging, and school expenses for Bob and myself, the third section concluding abruptly after reassuring us that we'd be hearing from him again before long. Later, I would discover in a first-year college composition class that my father's letters had been written in a diamond sequence, the poetics of correspondence requiring an open greeting, a middle detail or request, and a brief farewell at the end. The letter-writing process had been such an agonizing chore for my father, one that he'd hurried through while assembling our survival money, that this specific formula, which he followed unconsciously, had offered him a comforting way of disciplining his emotions. "I was no writer," he later told me. "What I wanted to tell you and your brother was too big for any piece of paper in a small envelope."
And that's Edwige Dandika reading from her new book. It's a memoir called Brother, I'm Dying. And later in this book, you say that you felt both you and your father were afraid of breaking each other's hearts.
Yes, because actually with these the balance that he was treading with these letters was that he didn't want to say anything about, sort of too happy about his life in the United States, because that would make us feel excluded. He didn't want to say anything that seemed to criticize my uncle. He didn't want, so it was a very, you know, I'm sure that the words were selected so carefully. Mm-hmm. And then we would write him back eventually with the same care, you know, with careful not to say anything that would haunt him about things that had happened to us. So it was a very, I mean, communication when families are separated like that is very important. And we didn't have, it's not like now where even, you know, families in some of the furthest provinces in Haiti can, you know, people have the internet phones and things like that, and you can, there are ways that you can actually see people. What we had were these letters, and sort of every 3 months we would go to a photo studio and sit for a portrait that we would send to our parents. So it was very, you know, so these moments, you know, where you were communicating had to be so carefully done. You know, it had to be very well orchestrated so that nobody would get hurt. And I felt like that's something that later on I carried over in my relationship with both my parents.
Well, we're almost up on a break here, but you talk about, and I love this, you know, smuggling words. And as a writer, I mean, words are your life. Words are mm-hmm. everything. And I imagine as a little girl getting these letters every couple of months, that every word mattered in that letter.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like those images, you know, people have in Victorian novels of just like pouring over a letter and clutching it to your bosom. And we didn't get to keep mm-hmm. them. And I remember later writing a short story where a daughter was communicating with her parents like that and rereading those letters. And sometimes it's so, you try to read so much into each stroke of a pen. And I think that does carry over to being a writer and you learn very early on the importance of words.
And even just because it's handwritten, sort of how the words look on the page, right, mm-hmm. can be very revealing.
Absolutely.
Edwige Dandika is our guest today on Radio Times, and she's a novelist and now a memoir writer born in Haiti, and she's got a new book, and it's called Brother, I'm Dying. Stay with us, and lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the ACLU, and the Free Library of Philadelphia encourage you to attend a reading in the fight against censorship. Local celebrities will read from their favorite banned or challenged books, featuring Jean Shea, actress Maydee DiStefano, poet Lamont Dixon, Cornell Knowledge Inquirer columnist Faye Flam, and Jennifer Steinberg of the Philadelphia Film Festival, Monday, October 1st at 7 p.m. at the Free Library Central Branch, 19th and Vine. Details at aclupa.org/bannedbooks.
On the next Fresh Air, Philip Roth on his new novel, Exit Ghost, his final book featuring Nathan Zuckerman. The reclusive Zuckerman returns to New York for a medical procedure he hopes will reverse the incontinence and impotence that resulted from treating his prostate cancer. In New York, he, quote, yields to the illusion of starting again. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM. 1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY and presents The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, starring Jennifer Childs in an array of roles, from jocks to supermoms to Trudy the Bag Lady. The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe is a classic comedy about staying in touch in a disconnected world. Through October 28th, tickets at 215-592-9560 or 1812productions.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Iwij Dandika is our guest. She's the author of several critically acclaimed novels, including Breath Eyes Memory, Crick Crack, The Farming of Bones, The Dewbreaker. They involve stories about Haiti, where Dandika was born. She's just written a memoir about her father, who immigrated to the U.S., her uncle, who died in a detention facility in Florida, and the birth of her first child, a little girl. And the book is called Brother, I'm Dying. 1-888-477-9499. Your Uncle Joseph, your Aunt Denise took care of you and your brother. They lived in Port-au-Prince, and your uncle was a priest, and it sounded like a priest that had quite a following.
Mm-hmm. Well, my uncle was, he was the first in our family to move actually from the provinces in Haiti to Port-au-Prince, to a neighborhood called Bel Air, which was a beautiful, you know, hilltop neighborhood when he moved there in the 40s, but over the years became a very volatile and a very poor area, a very politically active area too. And so he had a church there that he started soon after. He was an aspiring politician. He supported a populist leader, a man named Daniel Fignoli, who was replaced by Duvalier, Papa Doc Duvalier, who stayed in power for almost two decades. Mm-hmm. And so when he started the church, just shifted his attention to that and had a sort of a community center in the church where they had a school and a feeding center that he raised funds continually for by coming here to the United States and also among family members. And so he suffered from throat cancer in the late 70s, but continued to preach with a voice box. So we spent most of our childhood with him. He was a very, very wonderful man, very, you know, playful, very spiritual, just was a great role model.
And living under Duvalier, as you said, he had been supporter of a very different kind of government leader. Was he targeted at all by Duvalier or the Tonton Moukout?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons also he withdrew from politics after the Fignoli, who he had supported, was in power for 3 weeks and then was sent into exile. And at that point, his supporters, I think to stay in the country, those who didn't flee with him, just kind of withdrew and went down different paths, and that's why my uncle chose the church. He wasn't targeted at that point, but I was still living in Haiti at that time, and we had neighbors who certainly were, and sometimes it was just random, you know, that if something you had done was misunderstood, but somehow we were spared. I think in part because he had great community support. He had been amongst the people who lived in that area, one of the longest, had lived there the longest, and people in the community supported him.
Now, his church was attacked, was burned down, sort of caught in the middle of crossfire. What happened to him in Haiti?
Well, in the fall of 2004, it was the 10th anniversary of a coup d'etat against President Aristide that had happened in 1994, and so there were demonstrations, but there also, in Bel Air, a rise of some criminal gangs, and the way that the transitional government that had replaced President Aristide, the way that they would address that with the UN was to just attack these neighborhoods to go after the gang leaders there. And so in one such operation on a Sunday morning, they climbed on top of his church and then went and shot at people in the neighborhood. And when they withdrew from the neighborhood, the gangs came and threatened my uncle and threatened his life. And so he hid out. Some of the church people hid him in the neighborhood, and he was able to get out. And he got on a plane to come to Miami. He had been coming to the States for more than 30 years to visit, but had not really chosen to live here. Mm-hmm. But part of the church had been burnt down, and he had really the clothes on his back in a briefcase. So when he got to Miami and they asked how long he would be staying, he said he asked for asylum and was put in jail and died in custody of the Immigration Service.
In fact, he asked for temporary asylum. And he obviously feared his life had been threatened, and he feared for his life in
mm-hmm.
Haiti.
Well, yeah, because he, in the transcript that we got from the government of his interview at the airport, he kept saying, you know, there's a group that's trying to kill me, I fear for my life, and, you know, these are words that he kept repeating over and over, but he was not believed, even though he was 81 years old and he was sick, so he was still arrested and put in detention.
In fact, he was held at the Chrome Detention Center. This is a well-known center in Florida. He'd flown to Florida
mm-hmm.
and I guess was on his way to his brother, your father, in New York. Was that where he was hoping to go, from what you know?
Well, it was sort of a strange series of events, because he had a long planned trip to come late October, and when this happened, he moved up his trip a little bit,
right.
And so I live in Miami, maybe about 15 minutes from the airport where he was arrested on entering, and so I would have seen him, and then he would have, you know, he had plans to visit with some of the ministers and then fly to New York to see my father. He knew that he would overstay the 30-day visa that he had because, he wanted some time to see what would happen. But from all indications, mm-hmm. you know, with the things that he left behind and the people that he had talked to, that he planned to go back and try to continue his work.
Your book is about a number of things. One, the fact that he was detained by, I guess, Customs or Homeland Security in Florida?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first people he encountered were the Customs and Border Patrol, but soon then you're turned over to I guess it's all now, all of it is the Department of Homeland Security. So the detention center where he was held is run by the Department of Homeland Security. So when he was detained, the next step, he could have been paroled by the officers who he ran into, because he, for one, he has a history of coming to this country more than, you know, 3 decades long, and he was 81 years old. Mm-hmm. He was a survivor of throat cancer. He was obviously shaken from all that had happened to him. He has dozens of relatives who are U.S. citizens who live nearby. So he could have been paroled based on that ground. And he also had a valid visa that would have expired next year in 2008.
A passport.
Mm-hmm. So they still detained him. And when they took his medication, he was taking, at his age, at 81, a very careful balance of medications for his prostate and an high blood pressure. And medication, of course, people who have blood pressure know that if you're taking one medication, it affects the other. So his medication was taken away, and according to the Homeland Security records that we got, were replaced by something else that we don't know what they were replaced with.
Mm.
And so he, when I spoke to him and when the lawyer spoke to him, kept saying that they had taken away his medication. And so he became ill when he appeared before the immigration judge. And the medic, and this is again from the records, the medic who came thought he was faking. So he lost also very precious time in getting treatment within the detention center.
And died actually in a hospital emergency room and had to wait, I think, 24 hours before getting attention mm-hmm. there.
Well, he was, after he was, became sick in the detention center, he was taken to the emergency room. He didn't see a physician until after he had been at the hospital for 24 hours, but he was taken soon after the emergency examination by a nurse. He was taken to the prison ward in the hospital at Memorial Hospital in Miami. Ward D, which is a prison ward in the hospital.
You know this because you sued to get records for, first, the Freedom of Information Act, in which you got a lot of redacted pages about what had happened to your uncle, and then you sued and got information about what had happened to him, and some of that is reproduced in your book.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the interviews where he's being questioned about why he's coming to the States and what his intentions are here. Why do you think, here's a guy who would come, as you said, for 30 years, he'd come back and forth between Haiti and the United States, Why do you think he got tangled up in this bureaucracy this time?
Well, I think that because he said the word asylum, and the procedure usually, I mean, it's very, the way he was treated is very consistent with the way particularly Haitian asylum seekers are treated, especially in Florida where this happened, in that if you ask for asylum, you are immediately detained. And if you compare the number of asylum seekers, people who request asylum who are Haitian in Miami, compared to other groups, if you compare them
like
to Cuban asylum seekers, their numbers are very low, and they're often detained and immediately or soon after deported. So I think his treatment, in spite of his, you know, extenuating circumstances, given the fact that he was 81 years old and the fact that he had so many U.S. citizen family members nearby and the fact that he was sick, all of that was ignored, I think was just thrown aside to follow the larger policy, which I think is a very particular policy for Haitian asylum seekers, especially at the port of entry for him in Miami.
Because the different politics of this country looking at Haiti versus looking at Cuba, for instance?
I think so. I mean, because, for example, they were, ever since, you know, in the early 80s, when you have the first big wave of Haitians arriving in Florida by boat, I think there's been a particular targeted policy there, because there is a fear, frankly, that that's reflected in this policy, that suddenly all of Haiti will land in Florida. I mean, even in policy that seems to favor Haiti, when you have, for example, when the 1994, with the return of Aristide, when President Clinton had that intervention to return Aristide, part of when he addressed the nation, when he addressed the United States, what he was saying, well, part of our reason for going, there's the brutal generals, but also there's the fear of an overwhelming number of Haitians coming to Florida. So I think that's always driven that policy. And you have issues of class, of course, of issues of race, and all of that enters into it. And I think my uncle, and I've been familiar with this issue for a very long time, and I think what's most exceptional about my uncle's case is how unexceptional it is. Maybe not everybody dies, but if he had not died, he would have been, you know, probably on the plane the next week. He would have been deported.
And did he die because he was not allowed access to his medication? As you said, and it's in the book, some of the officials there believe that he was faking when he was obviously showing signs of distress.
Well, actually, writing that part of the book, I tried to use exclusively the information that I got from the government, because I didn't want people to say, well, you know, you got your sources and they say this. And they had interviewed this medic, an investigation by the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security that deals with these particular issues. And they had interviewed this medic, and he said, well, I just said that he was faking because I have a great deal of experience with these kinds of things, and he was looking at me in a way that he wasn't limp. And so he actually said that he made this judgment that he thought that my uncle was faking. I think he wasn't believed at many different points of the process, and I wonder sometimes if one person had just been humane and had seen him as a human being, if this would have, you know, just spiraled in the way that it did.
I guess your father, because he died around the same time, I guess he didn't see then these documents that you were able to get your hands on?
He didn't see them because we, one of the reasons too that we wanted to get the documents is what happened with my uncle is that basically after he died, we got a corpse that had been autopsied, and they gave him a cause of death, which they said was chronic and acute pancreatitis. And he had never shown in the whole time that we'd known him any symptoms of pancreatitis and had never been diagnosed with it in the time that he was in their care. So suddenly he died, and we got the corpse, we got his clothes in a bag, and in our case, I got the bag with the words deceased misspelled on the bag, on this clear plastic bag, with his belongings. And they wish you luck, and you don't get an apology, you don't get an explanation. And towards the end of his life, we tried very hard to visit with him in the hospital, but they don't allow visits in the prison ward because he's not just there with immigration detainees. He's also there with prisoners from all other parts of the prison system in this county. So we weren't allowed to visit him. Even the lawyer wasn't allowed to visit him. So I wanted to know for my father, who was just haunted by this, what had happened, sure. what his last days were like. So that's one of the reasons we fought very hard to get those documents.
And you got them. You actually filed a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. And you had the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center. I guess they had a lawyer there that helped mm-hmm. you get these documents.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have known actually how to go about this myself. And we knew we wanted to get the documents from the hospital, from the Chrome. And so through, I was able to get them through the Florida Immigrant Advocacy mm-hmm. Center.
But is your conclusion that because your uncle was Haitian, coming to this country, looking for some kind of asylum, temporary or otherwise, that he was targeted because he was Haitian?
I wouldn't say that he was targeted, that they said, oh, this is a Haitian man, we should stop him. But I think he was treated consistently with the policy that is set for Haitian asylum seekers. If he were a Cuban man or a man of some other nationality, I don't think he would have been treated that way.
And of course, in Florida, there's a sizable Cuban population. I'm assuming a good size Haitian population as well mm-hmm. in Florida.
Yeah, but there's a very different policy for Cuban immigrants. And it's not, you know, when one talks about this, people think, well, does that mean you want that to be taken away? No, I mean, I think it's just. It's just a very glaring inequality, and I think if you have an immigration policy, it should be consistent. And so, especially when it involves people's lives in this way, so it's not meant to say that the policy for Cubans should be changed or what they have should be taken away. I think just there should be some kind of consistency.
Now, you were living with your Aunt Denise in Haiti. Is she still alive today?
She died before my uncle did. And one of actually the one of the sad things about his what happened after my uncle died here, and things were, you know, the threats that he had received in Haiti continued even after he died, and the people that we knew there said, you know, don't try to come and bury him here, because, you know, the gangs are still there. They knew what happened, and they're just waiting for you guys. They're waiting for him, you know. And so we weren't able to bury him in Haiti. And the sad thing about that is that he had we have a family mausoleum there where my grandparents are buried, and my aunts, and so my uncle, after my Aunt Denise had died, had sort of prepared himself a place next to her, and so he was not able to be buried next to her there in Haiti.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Edwige Dandika, and she's written a memoir. It's called Brother, I'm Dying. It's about her uncle, who in many ways helped to raise her growing up in Haiti, about her father, who came to the States back in the early 1970s, and Edwige Dandika, also the author of a number of novels. This, of course, a memoir. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology supports WHYY. Through December 16th, Penn Museum presents the exhibition River of Gold, Pre-Columbian Treasures from Sitio Conte. Ancient gold plaques and ornaments, expedition photographs and drawings tell the story of Penn Museum's 1940 excavations in Panama at a cemetery discovered when a river changed its course. Details at museum.upenn.edu or 215-898-4000.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
McCarter Theater Center proudly supports WHYY and presents the East Coast premiere of Stick Fly through October 14th. This earnest and comedic look at a complicated African-American family in disarray is a play about fathers and sons, fathers and daughters, race, class, and privilege. Located in Princeton, New Jersey, McCarter Theater presents over 250 performing arts events annually. For more information, 609-258-ARTS or at McCarter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Edwige Dundika is our guest, and she's written a new book. It's a memoir called Brother, I'm Dying. It tells the story of two fathers in her life, Mira, the man who gave her life, and his older brother, Joseph Dundika, with whom Edwige Dundika lived in Haiti until she was 12 years old. Her parents had come to the States many years earlier. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about your father, but let's get a couple of callers in on the conversation. We've got Michael from Manayunk. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ms. Dandeket, I assume, and please forgive me if I'm wrong about this, but that you consider yourself both an American and a Haitian, a mm-hmm. person who is part of both societies.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
And I guess it'd be fair to say that over its history, the United States hasn't always had the best relations or policies towards Haiti in a general matter, and then certainly on a personal level, you've had this tragedy with your uncle that you've had to deal with. And I was curious, as an attorney who has worked with both asylum seekers and also people who are in prison, I feel a sense of frustration and sadness and anger at the way our society treats these people, but I don't have a connection to, as personal as you would, the groups on the receiving end of that. And I was curious as how you reconcile that in writing your memoir as being part of, you know, sort of both sides of that equation.
Michael, it's an interesting question. Thanks mm-hmm. for the call. Edwige Dundika, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and it's something that I think it's something that I felt like my father sort of helped teach us how to wrestle with, because even, you know, when I was a teenager, he used to we used to go with the church that we attended to visit people who are being detained in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in Brooklyn, and so I just felt like I learned from that, from those visits, even, you know, that they are, as many Americans know, you know, there are more than two sides to America. If you're an African American, or you know that, and if you belong to any other group than the majority group in America, you know that. And so I reconcile it and knowing and acknowledging that, of course, this country is has allowed me extraordinary privileges and has allowed my family extraordinary privileges, but there's been extraordinary sacrifice, you know. And so I know, and this is why, you know, I write the op-eds and the things that I do, because I also know the difference between the people and government and administration and the bureaucracy, and you try to separate these things, and if you do have both these identities, you try to speak and you try to change it as much as you can as from within. And I realized, you know, in one of the documents that we got in my uncle's case, is that there's a form called the discretionary authority form that the customs people have, where they're checking, you know, as they're deciding whether to detain or release someone, where one of the things that one of the questions is that, is there media or congressional interest in this individual? And so I feel, you know, just that, you know, I always knew it, but I think just you realize the importance of speaking out. And I realized, of course, because, and it's probably the fact that I have of my ease in both cultures that I'm able to, and because I also do this work, you know, that I'm able to speak out from within. And I really think that a lot of people don't know about these things. You know, they don't know that about the work that this gentleman, Michael, is doing, or that about these people who are in prisons, even in New York, Pennsylvania, here in places like Miami and in Texas, people don't know. And so I reconcile it by doing this, you know, by speaking my experience. As I said, both the privileges and the sacrifices of it.
You have an interesting phrase describing U.S.-Haiti relations and maybe even the history of that relations, quote, a mouse under a big foot.
Well, yeah, I mean,
three interventions by the U.S. over the last, what, 100 years?
The last 100 years, yeah. I mean, a lot of places in the world are like that, you know, like
feeling like a mouse under a big
under
foot.
Under a big foot, yeah.
Michael, thanks for the call. We've got Salva from Bucks County joining us. Hi, Salva. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. Good morning. And thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I want to praise Edwidge Dentica for her work, for her courage, for her determination. First of all, I want to comment on the letters because nowadays Haitian people with technologies, they do not write anymore. They communicate through internet or telephone or by other means, but not writing, which was a very good habit of having, because I've been living in the United States since 1977, and still now that's the way I used to communicate with my friends and families back there. Another thing I want to comment on is the immigration system. It is very sad the way your uncle was treated, and we have to recognize those who are the immigrants who are living in the United States. We have to recognize that although United States is a country of nations, but at the same time they have, it's a very discriminatory country because it has different policies for different people. And I personally nowadays, I discourage any Haitian people who want to leave the country and come to the United States for a better life. If they can leave home, if they stay home and live decently, it better to stay home rather than risking their life and coming here.
Well, that's interesting, Salva. Let me find out if Edwidge Dandika does the same thing. I'm curious, have you told people not to come to the United States, Edwidge?
Well, yes, you can come to visit, but not
right,
to
no,
stay.
I hear you. Yeah, no, I hear you, Salva. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead.
Thank you, Salva, for the call. I mean, I would never, you know, I would never say to people personally, I wouldn't say not to come in spite of all that, you know, that's happened, because I think there are people who, like my uncle, had no choice, you know, and I think people... That's the part that's often misunderstood too. I think that the policymakers misunderstand and that they assume that everybody's coming for economic reasons, which is not, you know, it's not always the case. There are people who are coming who are truly fleeing for their lives, and so I think that's a choice for everybody to make. But I agree in the sense with Salva that we have to, and Haitians have to be part of this too. We have to work on things that make people want to stay home. That make people policies and structural changes, and even people who claim to be friends of Haiti. I mean this on a government level. People who are helping, who want to help the country, to try to create opportunities for people not to have to take these extraordinary means of flight to risk their lives only to come here and then to be returned.
Salva, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And in many ways, this book is about your uncle, but it's also about your father, who had come to the country when you were just a little girl. I think it's your brother who asks your father, you know, do you regret coming to this country? And he says, after saying a number of different things, bottom line, he said, I've had a good life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when my father was one for the formal letters, but also very formal meetings.
Is that right?
As we called sort of the family summits, and when he found out that he wasn't going to get well, he sort of gathered us all, and then my brother asked him about whether he had enjoyed his life, and he really, I mean, like a lot of immigrant parents, I think, sort of gauged his life by how his children had done, and really this was the measure by which he judged success, you know. And he said, well, you know, I've had a good life because basically you guys have done well. And I think, you know, this, my father, you know, and I feel connects me with all these immigrant families and with the 12 million that people are always talking about, because this is essentially for a lot of families, why people come, why they take these extraordinary risks, and why I wouldn't say to people not to come myself, because often they're sacrificing themselves for a future for their children. And so my father really, I mean, towards the end, when my uncle died, he started sort of questioning. I mean, I think it felt to him like a betrayal, because he felt really like he had given so much to this country in his own way. But really, I think with his last breath, probably thought it was worth it, because we had done, he, you know, my brothers and I had done okay.
And when you came to the, you were 12 years old when you came to the U.S., they were living in New York, in Brooklyn, and one of the first things he gives you is a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
He knew you wanted to be a writer? Or
yeah.
He sensed you wanted to be a writer?
Yeah, I had told my uncle that I wanted to be a writer, and perhaps they had discussed it, but my uncle had said, because also growing up during the dictatorship, a lot of the writers were exiled and had had to leave the country. So my uncle used to routinely discourage me, and he said, and my father too. And I, you know, he had a joke. I would say, I want to be a writer, and he said, you can do that on the weekend after brain surgery.
And he wanted you to be a doctor during the week, and a writer on the weekend.
Exactly. He's like, oh, you can write anytime. And so, but he still gave me that typewriter, because I would always ask him for a typewriter when I was in Haiti. I really wanted the typewriter for my uncle, and so I would write and ask for it. And then when he gave it to me, I thought it was, I mean, I think on some level, I mean, it's, now I'm a parent, my daughter's very young, but I think on some level we try to anticipate the needs of our children. And I think from a distance, especially probably from across an ocean away, you can always, you know, I had a conversation once with my mother where she was saying, well, you know, she said, every time I ate, I wondered if you were eating. And I think it's like that. I think when you're separated from your child for so long, you really try to anticipate. You want to make them happy in the sense that whatever way you can. And one of the things when we just got here, my parents, especially my father, really tried hard to earn our love. And one of the ways that he did that was a typewriter. But maybe there was something, you know, I'd like to think that there was something under the surface about it, and that he, you know, that there was a seer in him that wanted to encourage my wanting my writing.
Well, you have to pay attention. I mean, even if your children are you know, thousands of miles away, to pay attention to who they are and what they actually do want.
Exactly. And I can imagine that perhaps they like he had just paced it, and he thought, okay, maybe this is the time for you to have it. This would be the most important time for you to have it.
Well, I'd love to have you do another reading from the book. And your father had a terminal illness, and this is a scene where you're with him, and let's listen.
We could smell it before we saw it. A new batch of long grain white rice prepared for my father by my mother. This time she brought it up herself, and not on the bed tray, but on a round silver center from the special cabinet. My father raised himself on the bed to receive it, and as soon as my mother handed him the spoon, for he always ate his rice with a spoon, he immediately dived in. He barely chewed at all, simply bouncing the grains from cheek to cheek, then swallowing quickly. Had I not known, I would have thought him famished, ravenous, even insatiable. And perhaps he was, or maybe he was desperately trying to nourish himself with something recognizable and familiar. When he was halfway done, my father handed me the plate. "Do you want some?" he asked. "There's more in the kitchen," my mother said. "She can have some later. This rice is for you." "Let her have some," he insisted. I reached over and took the plate. Using my father's spoon, I piled a mound of rice into my mouth. It was plain but flavorful. I suspected that my mother had slipped in some broth or margarine, even a few drops of coconut milk. I realized that afternoon that for nearly a year, while my mother, brothers, and I had constantly carried food up to my father, we had rarely eaten with him. Somehow it hadn't occurred to me that he missed sharing a table or a plate, passing a spice or a spoon, but he did. Just as he missed seeing certain faces and places and hearing certain voices that neither his friends nor family nor the television could successfully transport to his room.
I love that passage. It says so many things, first of all, about your father, and also about what it's like in those last moments in someone's life and what's meaningful to them and what it's like to be with them and to share not just a meal but to share a spoon with him.
I think it's extraordinarily isolating to be sick. And I certainly realized that with my father, to be suddenly plucked, you know, from life. My father was a very active man. He was active in his church. He worked very long hours, and to suddenly be unable to go outside was very painful for him. And he did try these, you know, to have these very small but, you know, meaningful moments of contact. And I really do feel like he was teaching us. I mean, I didn't get a chance to say that to him because something I realized later, but it's an extraordinary thing to have had a parent who, as best as he could, you know, had taught you to live. And I've just felt towards the end of his life that he was teaching us how to die, but how to expect his dying. He was teaching us how to say goodbye.
And we're almost out of time here. He did get to hold his granddaughter. Yes, your daughter.
He got to hold my daughter Mira soon after she was born. They spent a wonderful month together, and 3 days I had to go back with her. 3 days after I went back, he died.
You think he was holding out?
I think he was holding out both times. I think he was holding out for her to come because we had so many discussions about that, and he used to say, you know, I want to see the firstborn of my firstborn. He's a very, like I said, a very sometimes very formal man, but I think he also didn't want me to. He didn't want me to have them both at the same moment, to hold, as I say in the book, to hold his corpse and to hold her at the same time.
Well, as always, Edwige Dunnicutt, a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times. Thank you so much. And it's a beautiful book.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Edwige Dunnicutt has been our guest, and her book is a memoir, and it's called Brother, I'm Dying. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Find out more about the program, including podcasts. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, and Susan Greenbaum produce Radio Times. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.